You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me is another whiner, although that's normally not his nature, but whining like an old washerwoman. That's right, Philip E. Smith. Why would you come on and like immediately start whining?
Well, because it's just a little bit too cold to be out working with wood.
Don't you have a heater? Look, no, it's not. All that means is you got to do a little upgrade in the shop. You got to get the appropriate number of heating devices in there, and then you're good to go. You can keep it going.
Yeah, I know. I got to do that. Maybe that's one of my 2018 goals.
Yeah, insulate. We got to make it all purpose. We got to make the shop all purpose. Got to get a little bit of insulation in there. Got to plug up that draftiness. Because it also helps when you get that swamp ass heat down there. That's not real good for the shop either. So we got to have appropriate insulation, air conditioning, and heat. Add that to the list. Let's get that done today. What's the temperature?
All right, yeah, we're working on it, buddy.
What's the temperature in South Carolina today?
Right now, I think it's 26, 29. It wasn't too cold last night. It got down to 23 here. The night before, it was 10 in our place here.
10 above?
So we're actually kind of on the rise with the heat index.
So things are looking up. Things are looking up. We like that. All right.
Yep, like 2018, things are looking up.
Things are getting better. Have you seen the movie The Postman?
I have.
Yeah, Kevin Costner. That's what he would say to people when he'd go around and deliver the mail, kind of a little bit of a con artist. What's the president have to say? Things are getting better. Things are getting better. So how's everybody dealing with this kind of cold in South Carolina? What are you guys doing?
Well, I think the biggest thing most of them do is make sure that their water pipes are wrapped. And I know that the gas company and the electric company have mobile teams out to go out and help people make sure that they have gas and electricity. And there were a few power outages for some unknown reason in the local area, but that's the primary thing they do is just make sure people have gas and electric.
Yeah, the biggest, you know, one of the biggest problems is pipes freezing, you know, people. But and then normally when electricity goes out, it's because you get a little bit of ice and on trees and things like that that aren't used to that kind of weight and kind of snaps a little power line. And you got to deal with that, which is not. Let me tell you, that's life and death stuff, especially in part of the country where. You know, houses, for instance, in the northern tier where you expect this kind of stuff, the pipes don't run outside. You know, the pipes go inside the house, and therefore they're insulated. They're not subject to the same issues that people have. And then the other thing is, homes aren't made with the kind of insulation in the warmer climates that they are in the northern tier, and that piercing cold. That penetrates the house when you don't have that kind of insulation. So the heat, the electricity going out is no small issue as much as I may make fun of you all. I was going to say in an emergency, they just fry up a little bit more muskrat and then we just kind of deal with it like that. But no.
Yeah. No, I think they just knuckle down and deal with it. It's kind of amazing the resilience of people, even though they don't plan for this and that. They have a resiliency that I think they have a tendency to overcome whatever problems they got.
All right. Phil Smith, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, infantryman. He and I taught together for a brief period of time at the Infantry Officer Course, led at that time by the current Chief of Staff of the White House. How funny is it to say that?
That is pretty awesome.
pretty,
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I tell a story, and I'm sure Smitty will recall, but Major John Kelly, who he had a bad shoulder when he was in Quantico. And he would go out for a run. Now, and running the loop in Quantico was 8 miles. Quantico gets hot in the summer and humid. I remember when he comes in, and he'd gone out and run about probably 2.5 miles. He comes in sweating his ass off, and he flops down in a chair, and everybody's kind of working, and he goes, "The loop's a bitch today." And with that, everybody stopped what they were doing and turned. What did he just say? nobody had the balls to ask. How would you know? And did somebody running by you tell you that?
Yeah.
And then he just looked like, "What? What are you looking at? Oh, you don't think I run the loop?" Like, "Oh no, sir, we believe it." But Kelly is a funny guy. All right, I asked you to come on to do some predicting here. Are you ready?
Yep.
All right.
Let's do it.
Give me a prediction for the Marine Corps in 2018.
I think they will become more special operations like. Both in size and in function. I just think that they are finally, the leadership is finally recognizing. I think a lot of us who have been down at the operating forces and kind of the mid-grade staff level for a number of years have recognized that the Marine Corps is just a little bit out of whack with what the nation needs. I think the Commandant has even been on record here within the last month or so of saying, "Hey, we've got to do something a little bit different." So more soft-like in their operating style. And I'm not talking about MARSOC. I'm talking about MUSE and the Marine Infantry units that deploy with MUSE and certainly at the regimental level. The team members will become more mature. I think from the manpower side, there's change in the offing with regards to older and wiser squad leaders.
Okay.
Junior enlisted.
Let me stop there.
Okay.
Older. There's much written about that, but our force structure doesn't support older and wiser. Even though you can make the argument with all the technology that's being pushed to the squad level, somebody in their first enlistment probably is not the guy who's going to synthesize all that and be the guy to direct that. It probably takes somebody, midway through a second enlistment that has enough experience both in leadership and professionally to go ahead and harness all that. So does that mean you see the Marine Corps making force structure adjustments to in some units, maybe not all units, but in some units have squad leaders as that are staff sergeants?
Yes, I would think so. I personally think that that's a good idea as to whether or not the Marine Corps gets around to actually changing the force structure to allow it, or whether they just keep it a manpower problem and solution kind of remains to be seen. But I would certainly think that a force structure change in alignment with the mission change, that the Marine Corps is going to become more soft-like, more, responsive to these types of, conflicts that we're seeing beyond just what, the MU, can do in 30 days and a MEV can do in another month or so after that. But, so I think, mission change is coming, and that'll force the force structure review, part of which will be on the manpower side, the recognition and the actual inclusion of more mature, age to force squad leaders type deal. It'll take them 3 or 4 or 5 years to figure all that out, but the Commandant can effect that change now through a force structure review and take on a new mission that you can last.
All right. Give me when you look at that, what does it look like in your mind's eye, Smitty, in terms of more tailored to the current needs of the nations? What does that mean, and how do you see that manifesting itself in Marine Corps mission sets and structure?
Okay, I think on two perspectives. One at the MU, and the expeditionary unit is they're going to have to become or accept more missions of punitive type actions, punitive expeditions. And the second thing is on the line with the special operations modus operandi is they've got to be more advisors. I think we've talked about this a little bit before.
Yeah.
But if you're going to not be engaged with conventional forces in multiple conflict spots on the planet, then you're going to do it by proxy, you're going to do it by advisor, you're going to be doing it by working with host nation partners to get them to the point where they can actually take on an adversary, whether it be remains of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other terror organizations or any other state-sponsored type of to include Iran, actually. That's the way I think we become more effective for the 21st century for the needs of the nation. So, talking about regime change from a conventional aspect, you actually conduct regime change from the bottom up. So the punitive expeditions on the mission aspect, and then in practicality, more advisors and advising. And I'm not just talking about staff NCO and lieutenant, captain, major advisors. I'm talking colonels. I'm talking generals at the higher ministerial level, and then perhaps that will drive the requirement for the State Department to take out State Department advisors to tie together both a political and military aspect of whatever country or host nation we're trying to assist in helping.
Interesting. All right. First of all, this is being recorded, so you may hear these predictions back again in the future, just so you know.
Okay.
All right. Next one is give me a prediction on Korea. News over the weekend that the phone line that has not been active will be activated again. What President Kim said that he hoped that they could enter into a dialogue that would allow North Korean athletes to participate in the Seoul or in the upcoming Winter Olympics. I'm not sure how that happens at such a late hour, but nonetheless, that was expressed. What happens on the peninsula in the next in 2018?
I think at the larger regional level, I think the region, and I'm talking about China, South Korea, Japan primarily, will coalesce against any aspirations that the regime may have, either militarily or humanitarian, against his own people. I don't think North Korea does any kind of aggression, military or otherwise. I think they understand braggadocio and force more than they respect just what we say that is often different than what we do. So I think the fact that the United States has now grown some stones and have been able to back it up with military potential, that Kim has reached his limit of ability to respond either militarily or otherwise, so he's going to go back down in his hole and do things like this, which is pretty typical, I think, for dictators. They push the limit with what they think they can get away with, and then when somebody calls their bluff, they go back down into their hole. So I don't think there'll be more talk. There'll be more efforts like this to engage the regime, which I think is always a good sign. I think there's always positive benefits that come from either side wanting to talk to the other, and I think there'll be more opportunities like this for the two elements or the region specifically. I think that's really what the U.S. administration wants, is a regional solution, not so much the United States kind of poking and actually being part of it, but leading the effort with China, South Korea and Japan kind of, you know, taking the lead. And I think one of the aspects that may come out, probably not 2018, but I think Japan's on its way to getting a military nuclear capability. I think that would be a good thing.
Let me follow with a general question. Is the world relearning both in Eastern Europe relative, and I'm talking about NATO in Eastern Europe, and NATO in Europe in general, and also our Pacific allies, is it relearning the significance of peace through strength?
Yes, I think so, if we've ever learned it in the past. The problem has always been what kind of strength do you back up your actions and your national strategy with. Strategy is not just military. There's all kinds of elements that go into a national strategy. Military is just a part of it. And we have had a tendency, I think, in our country to have a military strength as opposed to any other kind of a strength. So I think that's kind of what we're seeing is a little bit more of a balance of military strength with political will and other economic things that we can do across the planet to educate folks that it is about peace, it is about America first, and it is achieved by multiple layers, multiple elements of strength. And now the trick is to make sure that in each of those things that we've said that we're going to strengthen, military, economic, political, diplomatic, that we actually follow through with those things. That's typically where we kind of drop the ball. Sometimes it's been military, not usually, but mostly it's something with regards to economy and diplomacy that we cannot follow through with to back up what we say with regards to, you know, peace through strength. But yes, if we've ever had to learn it and didn't, we're having to relearn it for sure.
My guest is Phil Smith, a retired Marine colonel, infantryman, a veteran of Grenada, Beirut. Where else?
Somalia.
Somalia.
And then a year in Afghanistan and then the other year.
All right. The I want to. Where did you advise in Afghanistan?
I was the head advisor for the 201st Corps in the central region, central province. It was located in Pulacharka. It was just outside Kabul, and I had the police, the Afghan police. I was responsible for its advisor capability as well. So. A lot of responsibility in too short a time to see it through.
All right, you need to come back on. I want to talk about advising because it's a big deal, and as you said earlier, it's a part of our military that continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think the blueprint that got kind of laid down in Syria and Iraq is now being used. It's now being used in Afghanistan relative to where advisors go, what they do, so they can accomplish two things. One is bring the maximum amount of combat power that can be brought by when the United States is your ally. Two, also the advising piece, the same. But three is not suffer American casualties. That now get troop numbers in the headlines, now get that discussion in the headlines. And I think all those are extremely important because I think the American public will support the global war on terrorism, but I think they get tremendously bothered when we suffer casualties. And it seems like in Syria, we found a way to kind of serve both masters, which is extremely difficult. And I think that those sorties now that were in Syria are now piled on top of what was in Afghanistan, and the Taliban is feeling the same kind of heat. And as the fighting season comes, I think the landscape will be much changed in Afghanistan, and all for the good in terms of our ally. And I think that the president's tweet on New Year's Day was a part of that. is that things are going to change in Afghanistan, and that the Department of Defense, fresh off very, very positive results in Iraq, Syria, is looking to do a similar version with the Taliban to force them to the table to a negotiated settlement of that conflict. And so I think it's very, very interesting, and the advising piece is no small part of it.
Yeah, there's actually two aspects that I'd like to comment on. With advisors specifically, their attitude is a little bit different. The advisors know they don't have American conventional forces to call on unless it's a medical or logistics. But from a fighting perspective, the expectation of an advisor is his job and role is to get the host nation or get the partner military capability to a point where it can fight. And I've always thought that the Afghans can fight their own Taliban pretty effectively. What we did wrong, I think, in my view, is try to make the Afghan army like the American army with technology and equipment that they had no concept of how to maintain. And the other thing with regards to casualties, I've often thought about this, but I don't think the reason why we're doing advising as a strategic element is because of casualties. I've always thought the American people were not as casualty adverse as military leaders were. So I think what we're seeing over time is military leaders understanding that if you better want to support the nation and its strategic goals and objects of being leaders instead of being conventional occupiers, you've got to do it a little bit differently, as opposed to doing it a little bit different just because, you know, conventional wars bring casualties. I think that if there's a conventional war in Iran or North Korea, the American people will be all about it.
No, you know what, Smitty, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you on that. Where I would draw the line is when we get into these open-ended, where we don't see progress and people are pissing down your back and telling you that it's raining and we're still there and there's still young Americans dying. I think at that point, the American public looks and says, what are you doing? And I think they should look at that and they should demand an answer. What are we doing? And I think too many times, for instance, you know, what happened in Iraq was done on the back of young American soldiers and Marines primarily. Okay. You had a Secretary of Defense who tore up the war plan and wrote his own and sent an undermanned American military, kept an undermanned military there playing whack-a-mole. And the only reason that thing turned out well, or, you know, and again, this is the second time we've had a chance to create something post-conflict, which you're facing now. The only reason that chance even exists is because of the courage, selflessness, and the capabilities of young American Marines and soldiers who fought, you know, like crazy there. But they were never served well by the Secretary of Defense, and because they never had it in their favor. And so there was always too much room there for bad guys to operate. And so I think Americans get frustrated after years of that. I think they're extremely patient initially, but when it goes sideways for years, I think then they quite rightly look and say, this is bullshit, man. Why are we still there? You geniuses,
yep,
you geniuses can't figure it the fuck out? Come on.
Yeah, and I agree. And part of the confusion and misunderstanding, at least from the military perspective, is not being able to communicate or convince folks that these kinds of conflicts, once we get involved with, and I'm talking about the stability ops and counterinsurgency primarily,
right.
That those are long-term things. So we have to be upfront with the American people to, hey, this is gonna last 15 years. And we owe you,
but we never say that, Smitty. That's my bitch is that you don't have somebody that will step in front of a microphone and say, I want to prepare you for what's coming up. We've now completed what we would call the kinetic phase of the operation. Now what we're doing is, whether we like it or not, is we're in the nation building business. We've taken on a project in Afghanistan. right, that we're trying to bring into the 20th century. And when we can get it to the 20th century, maybe we can yank it into the 21st. Okay, but that's where we are right now. It's not going to happen overnight. We were in Germany and Japan. Hell, we're still there, but we were there primarily for 60 years. In each nation, we're still in Korea. So this will be a similar undertaking. We believe, though, it is in the nation's best interest and will promote peace and stability in that region. And you could have made the same case in Iraq as you can for doing that in Afghanistan. But nobody will come on and say that. And I don't think if you give the American people a plan and you lay it out for them, and because we all know that's the way it goes. It is not going to happen tomorrow. And in fact, even the guys that go back now to Afghanistan, the ones I've spoken to say, Mac, you can't believe the difference in the way the Afghan army operates. You know, they're head and shoulders above what you saw 6 years ago. You know, they can go do it now, and we've learned a bunch too. And so this is so much better than it was before. We now have a chance to actually do those things because they're more mature. You hear that stuff, and you're like, wow, well, that's good. That's good. But, you know, for politicians to lay it out, you know, in a vision, I don't see that often enough.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking necessarily of the politicians being able to do it. I think the politicians would probably parrot whatever our military leaders think. So if we have military leaders that only think conventionally and thinking short-term victories, then that's what the nation's gonna believe. But if we had military leaders that stood up and said, like they did in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. This is the one example that I always like to use with regards to that topic of casualties is, you know, they said, hey, this is going to be an open-ended event. Expect 10,000 casualties in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And at least from a national perspective, there was no blinking of the eye. Everybody understood. That came from, I think it was Schwarzkopf or one of his guys that said that. And maybe it was even the president that said it. I can't remember. I'd have to double check on that. But there was no blinking of the eye. And they said, yeah, go do it. Take it back. And there was no expectation that we'd be there for a long period of time. And that's probably one of the reasons why it was readily accepted was there was a short-ended type of a thing, even though there was no end date associated with it.
Right.
It was strictly a conventional.
Yeah, but come on, it was an anomaly, right? Nothing is like that. That was like it's like going to Disneyland for God's sake.
Yeah.
It's not the way the world really is. It's the way you want it to be. And lo and behold, we have an idiot who goes and lays down in the desert, right? Almost like we practiced it in front of us. I'm like, hello. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You know, we're shooting from 3,000 meters. Our tanks are engaging him before his can even acquire us. Our tanks are killing them. In fact, at such a distance that our tanks aren't even sure if they're dead because they can't see that far, but they can gun that far. Anyway.
Yeah, but my point wasn't necessarily the military capabilities one way or another. It was the fact that somebody stood up and said, hey, expect 10,000 casualties. It's an open-ended event, but we have a limited objective, and here we go. Now, if the American people had reacted and said no, you know, somehow through their elected officials and said, no, we can't accept 10,000 casualties, you're not going to do it, what would have happened? But there was no human outcry. It was, 10,000 casualties? Yeah, the American people, they're blinking an eye. They'd give it up if the cause is just and somebody communicated it to them that way. Either the highest of military leadership or the president, they're all for it. Mm-hmm. Same thing would be for a campaign that lasted 10 or 15 years. And like I said, there's very few that are going to want to communicate that kind of thing.
Well, but again, look, if you're going to commit it, you ought to have the balls to say it, right? So what are we going to do? We're just going to do a drive-by on Iraq? Is that right? We're going to do a drive-by in Iraq. We're going to go there. We're going to do regime change. We're going to bring in a bunch of expatriates. They'll run the government. The Iraqis will go for that. We're out. Yes? Like, what idiots were in that OPT?
Yeah, way too many military, not enough academics and historians, although I think they were there. They were just ignored.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think they were ignored because if you saw the way General Shinseki got treated when he said you're going to need several hundred thousand soldiers to garrison, that testimony is chilling because he's asked, why do you say that? He said, well, you're going to take the clamps off of a society that has been, you know, forced together. And when you do that, if you don't have the resources there, you'll have civil war, you'll have an insurgency. And you sit there and your jaw hits it. Oh, and what happened after he said that? Oh, he got shown the door. That's right. Not going along with the party lines. All right, talk to me about most interesting here in the last week. Developments in the greatest destabilizing force in the Middle East, and that is Iran. Your thoughts on that? The last time this happened, President Obama thought he could deal with the Iranians, was very soft on them, did not stand up and support the Green Movement, as I believe it was called at the time. Different kind of American government in power right now. Thoughts on Iran? Is this something that they will quickly put down? Is it something more formidable?
I don't think the Iranian government will slap this revolution down quite as fast as they did the other one, primarily because now you have maybe indirectly because of the Iranian deal, that actually could be in our favor if we use its leverage. And also because there is a international agreement here on sanctions and some other things that are going on. So I don't think they're going to put it down. Another reason why they're not going to put it down is because...
Okay, hold on. I want you to footnote that. They're not going to put it down because of the Iranian deal. We may use them putting that down as a pretense to gut the whole thing.
I think we could use that as leverage, yes. I'm not saying that that's the way it is because I'm not privy to any Iranian government. I don't do Al Jazeera and all that stuff, although that's probably a pretty good source of figuring out what's going on inside the government. But we could use that as leverage to say, you need to let this revolution play out. You need to change your activities as a government. We did all these things for you and your people, and then you turn around and squash the very reason why we helped you. I think that would go a long way, along with the president standing up and saying, hey, we support these people. It's freedom. It's what we do in the West is we support freedom and democracy. So all those kinds of statements and whatever it is that we're doing economically sanction-wise, I think have a different impact on the Iranian regime.
Interesting. Because I don't know ultimately if you've read anything over the weekend. If you haven't, I would suggest you do, because I would tell you that what's going on in Iran is huge relative to the Middle East, because they are the destabilizing force in the Middle East. Hezbollah is gulping harder when they look at Iran turning inward. All right, in Yemen. Right? The Houthis, they're gulping harder when they think that the Iranians might be looking inward. Right? The Syrians are gulping harder when they think that that the Iranians might be looking inward. And what you hear is the Iranian people are fed up with its government going around the world sponsoring all these things, because that is a pro-Western nation underneath the government. And so if you meet Americans that travel there, they'll tell you that no, the Iranians are wonderful people. And they love the United States. Their government doesn't, but the vast majority of the Iranian people are pro-Western people, right? And it goes back to the Shah. And they had essentially a secular government with a West-leaning monarch. And those roots are still deep. And so layered on top of that has been this government. I don't see that government allowing this to go very far. because I don't think they can.
Well, I think they actually can. I think if they are, and I don't think they're rash. I do think that they're forward leaning. I do think they have a strategic sense that makes this particular revolution a little bit different than the previous one, just because of the things we'd already been talked about, the sanctions, the new deal, international commitment, those types of things. So they may kind of try to squash it. I don't think they're going to, unilaterally, kill people in the streets and those types of things. But they're going to have to make some kind of means to the people. They're going to have to change something. So that's what I think is going to happen. They're going to. They don't want the. They don't want Trump and the international community to kill the New Deal. So they're going to have to do something a little bit different. Interesting as to what it would be.
I'm interested. I'm keenly interested in how they'll handle that, because I don't know if they don't, if they let off the gas, there is no moderate form of what they do. When you talk,
you
talk about dialing that back, you talk about them dialing back aid to their foreign aspirations. That is a huge part of what they do, and yet it seems like that's the crux of, you know. And what you're talking about is because of the government's funding of that being squeezed by the price of oil, they don't pay their Social Security payments on time. They don't pay their public assistance on time. So you have people living, you know, like paupers who are owed pension by the government of Iran, and so not very happy in terms of that. All right. Are you okay with your crystal ball so far? You think?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I actually might put some of this down in writing a little bit. It's actually good thing.
All right. Let me domestically, I sent you a note that said we'd ask about the Trump investigations, but I don't really care to talk about that. What do you think is the biggest challenge in front of the nation?
Well, you know my interest in education, so yeah. I kind of read more education stuff since I retired than I had before. So I am very concerned about this free speech, universities establishing curriculum that teaches that the way to becoming an American citizen is through engagement and activism. I'm concerned about colleges and universities that are, it's almost counter-racism, where they are concentrating on courses that teach how to be civil as white people can be civil, as a an opposition to racism against blacks. It's just mind-boggling to me.
Not that you're averse to those principles, but that's how patriotism and being an American is taught. And to manifest that, I saw a poll recently, and the number was in, I think, the high 20s, that said that you have the right to go ahead and stop somebody from speaking if you disagree with their point of view.
Yep, that's right. And along with that is, in order to be able to say those things, you've got to be in a safe place. It's just mind-boggling to me that we've got educational leadership that even subscribes to this kind of stuff. So basically, civil discourse is kind of a thing of the past, where not only are we not being educated about American civil liberties and where democracy and where the republic came from, but we are no longer able to concentrate long enough to have a thought that comes out in completed sentences and words, either in writing or in oral conversation. A lot of it has to do with how parents are raising their kids. They're raising their kids to not be confrontational about anything. So as a result, we have adults that are a bunch of milquetoast people that don't know how to confront legally, don't know how to confront verbally, don't know how to confront in writing. And as a result, you have a bunch of people that are just, you know, walkovers. And that concerns me, I think, as a nation.
All right. I want to dovetail on that and get your thoughts on it. I think that the American military has a similar problem. The parents the helicopter parents are mid-level officers in the American military. Okay? And they're staff NCOs and officers in the American military. And I think that they come off standards very easily. And I say that because as I talk to different, more and more Marines, the things that I would call the basics, the structural basis of what it is to be a disciplined Marine, don't happen as often. And there's this kind of thought that we prepare for combat in the field. Well, the truth is, the way you are in garrison will be the way you go to combat. Right? If you don't inspect field day, and I know for people that listen to the program, they're going to be like, oh, not this again. If you don't inspect field day, if you don't require subordinates to inspect before you do, if you don't require them to stand in front of the area that you're going to inspect and tell you what you're going to find, if you don't exercise those muscles on a daily and weekly basis, then you don't build in the structure that and the discipline, the attention to detail, the punctuality, all those things that go into preparing people to go to war. We got raised to go to war, and we're fully prepared to do so by MNU-ing copper eyelets on war belts. Okay? by cutting the hair in our noses. Okay? And getting your ass chewed if you didn't do either one of those. For being on time.
Paying, paying rocks.
You would never even conceive of being late. So to send a text message to a squad leader because I'm going to be late for formation, like that's laughable, right? That's laughable. But when in an organization, right, where officers and staff and COs are so glued to their computers that they don't walk through the living spaces of Marines, when Marines believe that that space is their own and it's their private space, you're on the wrong course. And so the parallels that I see in the civilian world, I absolutely see them. And what I see is leaders, because the Marines are canvas, just like young people to go to school. They're blank canvas. They'll be what you make them, right? Marines are canvas, and they want structure, and they need it. And they come from a culture that doesn't embrace discipline and doesn't embrace structure. We don't like it. What do you mean? You're going to tell me what to do? Like, what is this? Oh, it's called the real world, bro. So I want to ask you about to comment on that. To me, I see more and more evidence that we want to get to Z, and we're not doing A, B, and C anymore. We are not brilliant in the basics anymore. And I'll tell you what, and the Navy is further down the road in it, but I would say they are borderline dysfunctional as a service. Your thoughts on the American military? Similar issues?
Well, generally, from an overall perspective, we've got to remember that the military follows in this pattern after the society, whether we like it or not, with regards to its people. And what it thinks, how it thinks about its role in the world, and so on and so forth. So that's always going to be the case. And the Marine Corps specifically has been able to fight against that a little bit by being very selective about who it lets in, and then also having a very focused training and education within the first year or so of a Marine's life and career, both officer and enlisted. So that's helped counter the cultural degradations and the cultural problems that that people bring to a military, whether it be social media, whether it be attention deficit or lack of knowledge about the country, confrontation between people, how you deal with confrontations between people. I came from a Marine Corps where confrontation, if it wasn't handled diplomatically, the guys just went outside and kicked each other's ass, and then when they picked themselves up, they shook their hand, and it was all over. I don't even think we contemplate or want guys to do that anymore, but there's something
Did I tell you about I was the guest of honor at a birthday ball? Did I tell you about?
Oh, no, congratulations.
I was obviously a thrill, and then my my number two son, Patrick, who's a platoon commander in 3-5, went with me, so it was fun to go to one with your son and be the guest of honor and speak.
Oh, yeah, awesome.
Yeah. But my message was this: fight. Somebody tries to haze you, fight them. Somebody tells you that we're going to go kill this guy and we're going to flex cuff him and throw him down by an IED hole, say you're not going to do it. Ask them if they want to fight. If they want to fight, fight. See what happens. Somebody tells you that they're going to call a recruit or you witness a terrorist, make him simulate slitting another Marine's throat and abuses them, tell them to stop doing it. And if they want to fight, fight them. And the look I got was, oh, I said, do you see all the bad things that have happened because of a lack of moral and physical courage? What do you think would have happened in those situations if somebody just would have looked at that guy who's got four daughters, gunnery sergeant with 14 years in the Marine Corps, and say, hey, Gunny, I'm not having that. You want to fight? Let's fight. But I'm not having that. What do you think would have happened? That shit would have stopped.
Yep. We wouldn't be reading about it in newspapers, that's for sure.
He wouldn't be going to the brig for 10 years, in theory. And same thing with urinating on those bodies. Somebody would have said, hey, what are you idiots doing? Knock it off. Right? I'm not having that. Ultimately, it's an act of love and devotion because somebody else is being stupid. I said, but don't be afraid to fight for the Marine Corps. What do you think? And so then I played a cut of the audio that I have of the Commandant, me asking him that question. He said, I said, so what do you, like, so if I get in a fight because I'm going to be hazed, he says, do you think I'm going to be mad at that? Do you think you're going to get in trouble for that? Somebody's hazing you and you stand up for what we teach. Do you think you're going to get in trouble, Mac? So I played that audio. And then I looked and I said, for those of you who don't know, that's a Commandant of the Marine Corps. It's okay to fight. Don't be afraid of it. Fight for what is right in this Marine Corps. Stop letting the idiots do stupid things and hurt and kill innocent people that send people to the brig, that ruin people's lives, that get them booted out of the Marine Corps. And then it was really interesting afterwards. I had a whole bunch of Marines, primarily staff NCOs, come up and say, hey, sir, I wanted to come over and shake your hand. That was an awesome speech. We needed to hear that. And I will tell you this, the squadron that I was with is called the Knight Riders. And they're a pretty storied history as a 46th Squadron in Vietnam at all the major battles from like 66 to 69 in I Corps. And it's transitioned to Osprey now. But you know how you can tell a good unit, Smitty? Just by the way they act, the way they greet each other, the way they are together. And now when you have a ball at a casino, 15 minutes after the music starts, how many people are left in the ballroom? Right?
Yeah. Right. Good unit hangs out at the bar.
They hung out. So the music starts, and I swear to God, two-thirds of everybody was on the dance floor laughing and having a good time. And, you know, all those little things that you see, and then standing there talking, you know, one after the other came up and said, "Hey, sir, that was awesome talk. We need to hear that more because we have people that are so afraid." Because as you said, Smitty, the way we used to solve things, now it's like being in high school. You can't get in a fight anymore. Are you kidding me? And it's to the detriment of the Marine Corps. Think about now you go as a company commander, you walk in, you turn your computer on, and you're sucked into that computer all day. Right? Back when we were lieutenants, right? Company commander showed up 5:30, 5:45. What did he do? Waited for the first sergeant. They walked the chow through their company area looking for trash. They had chow, looked at Marines in the chow hall, probably walked through the galley on their way out, and then walked through their company area again, probably stood off to the side to observe, you know, company formation in the morning, blah, blah, blah. That's where we grew up, right? And so what got paid attention to? You know, did the Marines do the cleanup, right? What did they look for formation? Why is that guy late, you know? And all those kind of questions about the unit. I'm not sure that stuff happens anymore. And if you're not, and so if you can't block and tackle, if you're not brilliant in the basics, and again, if you're not good in garrison, you'll be shit in combat. And why is that important? Because if you're shit in combat, if you're shit in garrison, more people are going to die, without a doubt. Anybody who's ever done it will tell you that. You're going to pay a higher butcher bill. So, I don't know. I'm just, and again, watching the Navy is nauseatingly painful. And the latest installment of it is this article that came out in Navy Times. You need to read it. I will send you the link about this sailor who hid on the USS Antietam for a week. The whole story.
Yeah, I saw that headline, but didn't read it. Read it.
The whole story is a shit show. His evaluation, his latest one said, must promote. The guy's out of his mind. He's out of his mind. he's missing. When somebody's missing at sea, Smitty, and you're the captain of the ship, what do? Man overboard, right?
Yeah.
You have to. He doesn't do that. He said, no. He said, I know he's on the ship hiding. Well, that's okay, but does 7th Fleet know that you're not going to turn back and look for this person now that they're missing? Based on your own gut instinct as a psychologist, as a CO of the ship? No. The Chiefs, after they do the search, he's seen by a sailor, but the sailor's scared of him, so he doesn't report it. The Chiefs then conduct their own search of the ship without telling the officers that they're going to do it. Right?
Unbelievable.
What? And so you see these things, and you're just going, oh, my God, man. It's shit on top of shit on top of shit on top of shit. And you're thinking these are – and the Antietam didn't run into anybody. It was just a ship out there functioning. And so – I'll send that to you, but again, I think there's this similarity between your comments about the educational system and what I would say is you watch the culture of the Navy and you hear things about the culture of the Marine Corps that are changing. And for a group that comes from this culture, our young people today, they don't need less structure. They need more. They don't need less
discipline.
They need more.
That's exactly
they,
right. Yep.
They need more. And I'm not talking about boot camp, screaming, yelling, discipline. I'm talking about they need leaders. They need to see leaders that make it make sense. Right? They need to be around guys like Michael Etor, guys like Phil Smith, you know, guys like Brian Zickafoos, guys like Sergeant Major Barrett. I mean, they're good men, right? They're funny guys. They're good dudes. But guess what? They're great leaders. And the one thing they do, they always take care of Marines. And that's why Marines will, without hesitation, do whatever they say. Yes, sir. Boom. And they're on it. And that's what we need more of, not less of. So I would call myself officially concerned for the institution of the Department of Defense based on a lack of embracing of the basic discipline that goes into being a military organization and wanting to be too nice, wanting it to make sense too much, not willing to fight. I think that those things are all very, very bad indicators, and hopefully they can be righted. So,
maybe Mad Dog Mattis will change the focus of the Defense Department with two words: sick 'em.
Well, I hope so. Let me just tell you, if there's somebody who could do it, first of all, he's got a giant intellect. For all his bravado and all his coarseness, underneath that is a brilliant guy. And I don't think it's lost on him what the DOD needs, especially and again, the Navy's the most visible example of it. But make no mistake, it's resident in all the services. And that is this pussification of the military, and it starts with basic discipline, and this kind of segmenting. Oh, well, combat's different. No, it's not. You can't do a list. You can't do accountability. You can't hold a formation. You can't inspect a field day. You can't have somebody standing in front of that barracks saying, "Sir, here's what you're going to find. In 218, there's a hole in the wall. There's a trouble ticket on that put in. We've been waiting for 2 weeks on that. A pipe broke last week and this. You're going to find this. You're going to find multiple shower rods busted, blah, 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 blah. All right, let's go." If you don't have that, then you're going to get guys killed that shouldn't be killed. So, anyway. My soapbox. All right. Any other predictions that you want to make that I haven't been smart enough to ask you about this morning?
Not because you weren't smart, but you just didn't have time to it. But I think the economy is going to skyrocket. I think it's going to be good for business. I think 2017 consumer confidence was on the rise. It's going to skyrocket, and I think Republicans are going to do well in 2018, and we're going to have Trump back in 2020.
Whoa. I would say that you've drank the Kool-Aid, but that's obviously a fact. Yes.
Well, it's not Kool-Aid. I think there's a little bit of optimism in there, and I'm not always that optimistic, but I'm thinking the American people might have already seen the light about the problems with socialism and the entitlement state, and I think they realize that they have to do more fighting to keep the republic going and its longevity. So we'll see.
You know, it's interesting. I would follow it up with a comment about the whole notion of globalism. You know, it's a fine academic concept. But at the end of the day, what you're ultimately responsible for is the maintenance of your state. And to the extent that the two can live compatibly, that's great. But at the end of the day, if you export all your jobs and you can't maintain the middle class in your nation, then you're going to have issues. Because when you only have an upper class and a lower class, historically, there are problems there. And the middle class in the United States is at risk. And so to me, I think the policies that the nation pursues now, and they are under Donald Trump, is we have to get the economy moving again. If you overregulate it, right, and you allow other nations to raid your industry, you're a fool. You're stupid. And it never this whole academic notion, you know, that then. I don't understand ultimately how it works. The other thing that I would tell you that is over the horizon, and I'll have you back on and we'll talk about it, is Google being too big, that controlling so much. You know, for instance, on your phone, and I just figured out how to turn this off last week. Why am I getting asked for pictures and reviews everywhere I go, right? George Orwell could never have conceived of, and it's not a government, it's a search engine reaching into your life the way it does, compiling the data, you know, it compiles on you. And those Google, Amazon getting too big for the American, for the American well-being. I think that's going to be a big issue in 2018. So
I hope it becomes a big issue because it needs to stop. Because you know, what it tells me is that the leaders of those companies, by allowing that to happen, by allowing their gathering of information on every American people just for monetary and other types of reasons, if they think that's right, then they're less Americans than we should let them be.
Yeah, but you know, they don't care. It's only about money, and unless I'm specifically told not to do it, I will absolutely do it, and that will be the way that thing works. So anyway, Smitty, first of all, Happy New Year, by the way, and I hope it warms up. I know that you you whiners down in South Carolina don't take the cold that well, so I hope it warms up pretty quickly.
I finished my cold weather training, so I'm not doing that anymore.
You're good. You're ready to be done.
Yeah, I'm ready to be done for cold weather training.
All right. How's your wife? Is your wife taking it well? Is she all right?
She does not. She does a little bit better in the cold than I do, but this is just a bit much for her as well.
Yeah. I would tell you that I define cold as 10 degrees below zero. Until you get to that point, it's just whatever. It's just another weather day.
Yeah. Too hard to exercise and breathe extraneously outside in that kind of weather.
Well, you know what? That is almost clairvoyant, because that's the point that I say that you can't do that anymore. That I would, when I was living up in North Dakota, you could PT outside as long as the wind wasn't blowing too much until you got 10 degrees below zero. Once you got to 10 below, you simply couldn't do it anymore. It was too difficult. So very, very perceptive on your part. I'm surprised.
The times that I've tried it, my lungs hurt way too much. That cold air in the lungs just kind of like freezes the capillaries or whatever those things are down there. Man, it hurts.
Really, I didn't really analyze it that much. I just know that, man, I got to go inside. I can't do this. So anyway. All right, bud. First of all, Happy New Year to you, and good luck with all the weather.
Yep. Happy New Year to you and your family.
All right. Thanks. That is Philip E. Smith, Colonel, United States Marine Corps here. Liberal arts discussion on current events. Anyway, that will end it. How about that? All right. Whatever you do, don't touch your dial. If you missed it, All Marine Radio reconvenes here momentarily. My thanks to John Ubaldi for coming on today. And then after him, Phil Smith, both doing prediction. So, for all you dealing with the cold, suck it up, man. Remember, until it gets to 10 below, it's not really cold. It's just you whining about it. So with that said, Happy New Year to everybody. Thanks for listening. You may not know this, but I will tell you. Email. Mac, where do I find that article about the USS Antietam? Just do a search on USS Antietam on the news tab, and you'll see it pop up. It was in Navy Times. And it's about a sailor by the name of Mims. He's a petty officer. So Mims, Antietam, USS, under the news tab, and it'll pop up. Honestly, it's astounding. So the other thing I'd tell you is Iran, extremely, extremely interested in what goes on there. And again, if you have anybody who's ever been to Iran, they will tell you. The Iranian people are incredibly warm people, and while the regime is certainly anti-American, the people are not. So, with that said, on a Wednesday that feels like the mother of all Mondays. Happy New Year. Hope you and yours had a great one. I did. My family did. So, Happy New Year. All Marine Radio, over and out.